Palm Beach County reopens slowly, understanding quarantine fatigue, and what's going to happen to tourist destinations like Wynwood. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Yesterday, Palm Beach County started to reopen. Folks there entered phase one of the reopening under the governor's guidelines. But did people show up to those retail locations? We're going to hear from one of the county leaders who's been pushing for this opening for quite some time. Also, people are experiencing quarantine fatigue. As Florida starts to reopen, will people continue social distancing and wearing masks? We're going to hear from a consumer behavior expert. And finally, communities like Wynwood thrive on visitors enjoying nightlife. With everything shut down, we'll explore how businesses are getting by and whether the neighborhood will have to change its identity to survive. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Well, Palm Beach County has reopened restaurants, hair salons, and some retail stores on a limited basis. It was a departure from Miami-Dade and Broward counties that remain on lockdown. Palm Beach, Dade, and Broward still make up nearly 60% of the total coronavirus cases in the state. Hal Valachet is the District 1 Commissioner in Palm Beach County. He's advocated for the county to reopen on a limited basis, and he joins us now. Commissioner Valachet, thanks so much for your time.
Hey, good afternoon. Nice to be with you.
And I would like to hear from folks in Palm Beach County. What have you seen as things have started to reopen this week, and what concerns do you have about restarting the economy? Share with us your thoughts, what you've seen, what you've experienced. Give us a call, 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. You can always find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Commissioner, so the county reopened started yesterday. Again, limited reopening, a phase one, just certain things can open. And again, there has to be, there are a lot of guidelines that people have to still social distance. But Palm Beach County is still third highest in confirmed cases in the state, and there was a little bit of a spike this weekend. Why do you believe that the county was ready now? You wanted to separate from Broward and Miami-Dade. You wanted to get phase one open now.
I did, and excuse me. The reason is twofold. One, I think we're quite a bit different from especially Miami-Dade County. Palm Beach County and my district up in the north part of the county are quite a bit less dense, and there's not nearly as much use of public transit. And as you know, in New York City, those two things have contributed to that place becoming the largest hotspot in the world. So I thought we were different. And even though we've had, the third highest number of cases, I think our case level, first of all, in the last couple of days, it's dropped radically. But I looked less at cases because there's so much noise in those statistics due to the variability in testing from day to day. I looked mainly in making my decision at our hospital availability, our ICU availability, and our ventilator availability, all of which have been flat to trending down. So we've got a lot of capability available. And, the initial goal of everything was to flatten that, actually the hospital utilization. And we did that. So I thought it was time for us to get a little more liberalization.
You know, one of the things when you talk about testing is that there's a consistent concern raised by public health experts in this lack of testing capacity. And many experts believe we simply do not have an accurate count yet because of the number of people infected with the virus. Where does testing capacity in Palm Beach County stand right now?
Well, it's coming up. I think we're a little slow off the mark, but we have opened a number of new sites recently. So, one indication to me is that our testing sites as well as our hospitals are under capacity. We're not getting enough calls to fill up all the appointments that are available every day. And what that tells me is, a lot of people are not feeling the symptoms that would require them to go in and get a test. So I think our testing capacity will continue to grow, but right now it's more than adequate for the demand that actually exists.
I'm speaking again with Palm Beach County Commissioner Hal Valache, and if you live in Palm Beach County, we'd like to hear your thoughts on the reopening that started this week. It started yesterday, and let us know what your concerns are. Are you going out now that some things are open? Are you going out and actually taking advantage of that? Give us a call, 800-743-9576. Again, that's 800-743-WLRN. I did mention, Commissioner, there was a spike on Friday and Saturday. Now, a lot of the new infections are in Belgrade and Pahokee. That's the western part of the county. That's a lot of agriculture, economically poorer communities. What are the resources the county is putting in trying to help that population?
Well, another thing that I've read about this, which I think is true, is that the outbreak there is in the correctional facility, which is, a very difficult problem, because those people are, by definition, in close contact with each other, and it's very difficult to, keep your distance if you're in a prison-type setting. But, Commissioner McKinley, who's my colleague on the commission and represents that area, is working very hard to get both more testing and more care for the area, which she's done, throughout the year, even before the pandemic and throughout her term. So she's been very involved and works with the mayors out there. Mayor Wilson in Belgrade is a terrific public servant, and he's, I think, working tirelessly on this.
Tell me about what has reopened. Remind us of what is actually now open for business.
Sure. Well, it's restaurants, and they are limited to 25% in an indoor setting. If they have outdoor seating, as long as they're following the CDC guidelines in terms of physical distance between diners, they can have, as many diners as they can fit in safely outside. Retail, again, at 25% capacity. So people are waiting to get into stores, and I think the merchants are very conscious of, keeping the number of people in their stores down. And hair salons and nail salons are open, and again, abiding by the very strict CDC guidelines. And, one thing that was pointed out last week during our discussion is people in that business have a lot of training in hygiene anyway, even before this whole thing happened. So they've always been very conscious of hygiene. And I expect that'll be, enhanced during this time.
Yeah.
But I think we started from a very good base of cleanliness there.
What have you seen or heard in these last couple of days?
All that I've been reading is that people have been very cautious about this. And I think that's a very good thing. What I wanted to do was give people the opportunity to make their own decisions, whether they wanted to go out or whether they wanted to continue isolating. And I think we're not seeing a rush. A lot of the restaurants and stores haven't opened yet. They're taking their time about it. We just gave them permission to do that if they wanted to. We didn't coerce them or force them into opening. So I think everybody's taking a very measured approach to this. And I also think that the habits that we've created in social distancing and hygiene over the past 2 months are going to persist. They're part of our daily life now, and I don't see any reason that they change.
So businesses have that choice if they want to reopen. Have you heard from businesses who've decided, not yet, we're going to wait?
I haven't specifically heard from them. I've heard more from people that did want to open, but that was prior to the governor, including us in phase one. So, no, I haven't really heard. I think this is going smoothly, and I'm just grateful that the rest of the commission agreed with me that it was time for us to give people a little more freedom.
Were there any challenges, or are there any challenges right now in making sure that people are following the guidelines, that if they're going, are we going to these businesses to make sure, hey, capacity's got to stay low, and make sure that people are practicing the social distancing, that businesses aren't trying to take advantage of the moment?
I really don't think they are. And I think we're trying not to be heavy-handed about any enforcement here. You know, one thing that's coming up next Monday is our reopening of our beaches. And, you know, obviously we had some concerns about that. We've seen crowd scenes in Jacksonville, et cetera. So,
and I want to ask you about the beaches. Yeah, because that's coming up soon. And I want to ask about the beaches. But real quickly, just again mentioning that we're talking with Palm Beach County Commissioner Hal Valache. Palm Beach County entered phase one of the governor's guidelines. They're reopening some businesses. And if you live in Palm Beach County, we want to know what you've seen, what you've experienced. If you are a business owner, have you decided to reopen? The number again, 800-743-9576. I'm going to go to the phones. I've got Bobby in Boynton Beach. Bobby, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I work in a barbershop in Palm Beach County, and those are reopening this week, and I'm supposed to go back to work on Thursday, and I have my concerns. I mean, we're going to require masks and gloves, but you can't really cut hair with scissors and combs with a glove on. You can do, you know, like the machine work and stuff, but and we're going to try to, you know, require people to wear a mask, but you can't wear a mask if you're getting your hair cut around the ears. You have to, so we're going to ask people to try to hold it over their face and try to clean everything in between clients. So it's going to be, you know, a bit of a pain, but I have some concerns about going back, you know, and that's, I just wanted to voice that. So,
you have that concern, but just real quickly, Bobby, are you more concerned about going back, or do you feel like I want to get back to work? I mean, which one is stronger for you?
I mean, I think, you know, everybody that has to work feels that a little bit of pressure that, you know, you need to at some point get back to work and make some money, you know, but there's also that, and I'm healthy. I'm 61, but I'm pretty healthy. I don't have any underlying conditions, but I don't know. I'm on the fence. I told them I would come back and work. They said yes. They gave me the option. They're like, you don't have to come back. It's up to you.
Yeah.
You know, I have that concern, and I'm like, you know, okay, because you can't cut hair 6 feet away from somebody.
Yeah.
You know,
it's good they gave you the option. Bobby, thank you so much for the call, and stay safe. Commissioner, I wonder, I mean, you hear that. People do want to get back to work, but there's still a concern. They're still worried.
Sure. It was heartening to hear that Bobby was given the option by her employer to whether to come back or not. And I would urge people, if they don't feel comfortable yet, please, you know, don't do anything against your own best interest, what you consider to be your own best interest. But the reality is, you know, until there's a vaccine or this dies out through population immunity, all of those, you know, high contact businesses like barbershops are, you know, that concern is going to be around, you know, for a year. And, you know, it's, I think, an evolving process for the shops to figure out how they best handle this and keep their employees and their patrons safe. But it's not as though if you wait, you know, another couple of weeks, it's going to be better. It's unfortunately, you know, until there's a vaccine or the virus goes away on its own, all those challenges are going to continue to exist.
We did get a question on Facebook for you, Commissioner. This is from Deborah. She says, quote, the commissioner saying there's not enough demand for tests, but the tests are only available to those with symptoms. What about asymptomatic people? Should they be allowed to be tested?
They should, and I think that we've had that discussion at the commission. Representative Schlossberg, who represents the south part of the county, came and told us that the South County Civic Center site was only testing people who are symptomatic, and I think that's been remedied. We were told by the county administrator that was going to be remedied, but most of the other sites within the county, you do not have to be symptomatic to get tested. So if your listener is looking to get tested, I would try the South County Civic Center site again, because I think their procedures have changed. But if they haven't, the other sites that we have would be able to test you.
And I do want to remind our listeners that you can go to WLRN.org. We have a list of the sites for testing and have contact information if you have to call ahead of time. Commissioner, the idea of opening beaches. So this is something that was voted on last week. But you said it yourself. We've seen not just Jacksonville. Recently, we saw Naples on the west coast of Florida. They reopened beaches and lots of people showed up and social distancing was out the window in many cases. What's your concern about opening up the beaches?
Well, certainly that, you know, and that was a factor in our decision to, instead of opening them at the same time we opened restaurants, to put that off until May 18th to give, you know, both the cities, because cities are involved in beaches like Boca and Boynton Beach, them, the sheriff, you know, the local law enforcement agencies, some time to prepare and to think about how they're going to manage the situation. I am very hopeful that, you know, the people around here are very cognizant of the dangers of, you know, getting into a mob scene. And I just, you know, don't see that kind of stuff happening around here.
Well,
but if it does, you know, we're going to, you know, have to take some action.
Will the cities be responsible for their own beaches, or is this the county, the sheriff, is going to have to?
Well, it's a shared responsibility. There are, you know, some beaches that are owned by the county, some that are owned by cities. So, but I think, you know, a beach is a beach, and there aren't markers on it where the city jurisdiction stops and the county starts. So, you know, I think it's going to be a coordinated joint effort, and it'll be looked at closely, obviously. I don't think anybody is going into this,
well,
cavalierly.
The other thing about the story with the Naples beaches, they were blaming people in Miami. They were blaming people on the East Coast, saying, look, we had all these visitors come over and filled our beaches. And then Key West and the folks in the Keys, they said, this is the reason why we closed off our doors to everybody, because we don't want everybody coming in. So are you worried that if you open the beaches before Broward and Miami-Dade, you're going to have folks from down here drive up there, say, well, I want to be on your beach?
Well, it's a concern. And I know that, you know, we have a beach task force, which involves, you know, citizens, not just government officials, thinking about how best to manage this. And they're going to come back with some recommendations Friday. We're meeting again Friday to sort of give the final okay to how we're going to do this. So I think there are going to be some proposals as to how we can control crowds and make sure we don't get into a situation. You know, the last thing we want to do is open beaches and then have to close them again.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's going to be some measures taken. And I asked the county administrator to make sure we have a lot of signage available and prominently displayed as you get on the beach, you know, reminding people what the guidelines are. So,
right. You know, interestingly, too, is you've had advocates for reopening unrestricted beaches at the commission meeting, and they raise the irony of having close in-person commission meetings while not reopening the beaches. I mean, what's the protocol of in-person commission meetings moving forward?
Well, in terms of the commissioners, you know, we've moved some of the staff off the dais, so that we can spread out up there. And I think we are actually 6 feet apart from each other. In the chambers where the public can come and listen to the meeting, we've we've blocked off, you know, 3 out of 4 seats so that people aren't sitting next to each other, that they're actually spaced out.
Are those the public, when they step up, aren't they sharing a microphone?
It's interesting you ask, because we do have staff that after every speaker gets up and sanitizes the microphone.
Okay, I mean, each person.
It's
okay.
Very interesting to watch, and they're doing a great job.
Let me get to the phones one more here before we finish up. I'm going to go to Dan in Boynton Beach. Dan, thanks for waiting.
Hi. Yeah. My question is, are they going to do any randomized sampling to help generate a statistical model of the infection rates in Palm Beach County as opposed to just on-demand testing?
All right, so randomized sampling testing instead of the way we have testing now, I think is what I'm gathering. Right, Dan? Is that what you're saying? Okay.
Yes.
Commissioner.
Sure. Well, I think you're probably referring to the Santa Clara study that was done, as well as studies in New York that, you know, indicate that anywhere from 5 to about 15% of the population is actually carrying the virus around and largely doesn't know it because they've been asymptomatic. Those types of tests are done by research institutes like Stanford. So I don't know that FAU has got one of those teed up to do here. It would be a great idea to do it. I don't have any reason to suspect that, you know, the infection rates that we've seen in a lot of other places in the country aren't the same as what we have here, which, you know, as you know, I think it should be some reassurance to the public that if 10 or 15% of the population has been infected, then the death rates and the hospitalization rates are much lower than they're being reported as.
And the University of Miami has done one of those sampling, antibody sampling tests here for Miami-Dade County we had reported on. Let me just, I want to finish with this, Commissioner, is, you know, all economies, the American economy, but, you know, we're talking about local economies, all of them have been hurt by this. What have you seen as to what the damage has been so far and what worries you most going forward?
Well, we haven't seen the results of it yet, but it doesn't take a rocket scientist to, you know, make an estimate of what's going on, you know, in both, you know, Florida is diversified a lot over the last 15 or 20 years, but we're still very dependent on tourism and retail and restaurants. And those are being hard hit. I don't know how many restaurants that have closed are actually going to reopen. So, you know, the devastation here is tremendous. And, you know, we have to get through this initial phase of trying to mitigate the effects of the disease. And then we go on, you know, our job is far from over when that's done, if it's ever done. But we've got to figure out how we provide some relief to our residents. We're very fortunate that the county received $261 million from the federal government, and we have a plan now to spend it both helping feed people, helping house people who might have lost their homes, helping small businesses, helping large businesses. So, you know, we've got some funds to be able to do that. And we need to, you know, at some point assess who's been damaged and how we can help them the best.
Palm Beach County Commissioner Hal Valachet, I appreciate the time. Thank you so much, sir.
Sure. Great being with you. Thanks.
And as we had mentioned, Palm Beach County entering phase one of the governor's guidelines. There are other phases. We have to slowly climb our way into each one. Well, still to come, are you sick of social distancing and wearing a mask? We're going to discuss surviving quarantine fatigue. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, you know, for weeks we've been social distancing, quarantining, isolating, and it's taking a toll. I mean, some of us are struggling with quarantine fatigue, and that may be one of the reasons we see people going in large groups to beaches and parks, and oftentimes they're not wearing masks. We're humans. We have to reconnect with each other. But we're not out of the woods yet. This virus has not disappeared. We're still at risk. So how does a politician's optimism or the concerns of the medical community shape our behaviors as well as this quarantining? How do our biases shape the way we behave during a pandemic? I'm joined now by consumer behavior expert and dean of the University of Miami's Herbert Business School, John Quelch. Mr. Quelch, great to have you back.
Thank you very much.
What's the best way to explain and understand quarantine fatigue?
Very simply, it's a physical issue as a result of lack of exercise, and a mental issue as a result of either isolation, if it's an individual living at home alone, or alternatively, congestion due to multiple family members living on top of each other for longer periods during the day and night than they would normally do.
And how does that quarantine fatigue then shape the way we behave when it comes to risks? And specifically, we're talking about the risks of catching this virus.
Right. People have different risk profiles. Obviously, some people are very risk averse and nervous. You can sometimes experience that if you're in a supermarket line and the person in front of you points out that you're not 6 feet behind them. So some people are very risk averse, and some people are very risk prone. They have an indestructible element to their psyche that leads them almost to want to take risk.
And so those are the people who are walking around maybe without a mask, or they don't care about social distancing or whatever you say to them.
Yeah, I think perhaps there are three explanations for that, at least three. One is I'm indestructible, I'm young and healthy, I'm not going to get it. A second is I'm going to assert my personal freedom, and I really don't care terribly much about the potential impact of my behavior on others. And, you know, thirdly is the notion that I just don't like wearing a mask. It's uncomfortable. It's unsightly. I'm a good looking guy. I need to, be seen and know I'm being seen.
And they'll do that even if there's a risk of catching a very contagious virus.
Yeah, as I said, people have a perception of risk that varies widely from situation to situation as well. So someone might go on a controlled visit, for instance, a time scheduled visit to Fairchild Tropical Garden, and feel perfectly safe. But they might go to a bar or a nightclub and feel much more at risk. So I think even for a particular individual, the level of risk that you feel is a function of the situation in which you're finding yourself.
I want to know how quarantine fatigue plays into this. As we've been forced to stay at home for a long time now, and as I was talking with the commissioner in the segment before about the economy, you know, we're getting to the point. I mean, a lot of people have already been there. They're desperate. We got to get back to work. We got to put food on the table. How does quarantine fatigue play into our fear of the virus, our concerns for our health, but also our need to take a chance and get back out there because we have to?
Right. So partially the fatigue could be a function of, hey, I'm not able to go to work. In some cases, of course, in many cases, people can work remotely from home via Zoom, etc. But that's a limited number of professional and office workers. And many other workers we know really have to be in a factory or in a restaurant in order to make money. And so part of their quarantine fatigue is obviously a function of worrying in their apartment about or their house about how am I going to put food on the table 4 weeks from now because my savings are running dry. So the economic uncertainty and the economic outcome of not working clearly plays into the mental health elements that are associated with the quarantine fatigue.
Which fear is stronger? Is it the fear of, getting the virus, or the fear of not having money in the bank account?
Well, the probability of not having money in the bank account could be closing in on 100%. The probability of getting the virus might be 1 or 2%. So I think I've answered the question.
Yes.
A lot of people are prepared to trade the second off in favor of solving the economic problem.
I wanted to ask you about the term diminishing marginal returns. I know this is an economic term, not to get too wonky, but diminishing marginal returns has been used to describe how the rewards we associate with staying at home are losing value. It's, again, this economic term, but explain how it applies in this situation.
Well, again, it goes back to the trade-off between the risk of going outside of the home and the economic consequences of not doing so. And initially, people are willing to comply. They're willing to stay at home. They will take on that measure of social responsibility. But if they don't see light at the end of the tunnel, then they start making a mental trade-off between being, quote, responsible, unquote, in a public health sense, versus wanting to have their life back and wanting to have income coming into their bank account.
And, you know, the value of staying at home, it was really high at the beginning. And so maybe I was, you know, a lot, it was easier for me to accept that. But staying at home this long, and I've watched all the Netflix I could watch, and I've done everything, all, you know, everything else I could do at home, cleaning it up and organizing, it no longer has that value for me.
Well, there is a novelty effect, obviously, associated with staying at home, and for many people, learning how to communicate and conference via Zoom, for example, was quite interesting, quite good fun at first. But many people, of course, are getting completely jaded with 5 or 6 hours a day on Zoom, and that's not not to even include the pressures that naturally come into a home environment when there is constant need for school-age children to be studying online, and for different members of the household to be able to find different personal spaces to retreat to and do their thing. You know, this is very difficult if you have a small square footage apartment that you're operating in with a significant number of family members.
Right.
So what seems tolerable, pleasant, and novel at first, you know, over time becomes confining and fatiguing.
I can attest to that. The smaller the space, the harder it's going to get. Again, we're talking with John Quelch, Dean of the Miami Herbert Business School at the University of Miami. Quelch, again, we're talking about the challenges of quarantine fatigue and how we should think about the need to return to a normal life while considering the risks and how all these things affect our behavior. I wanted to ask about risk. Something that I find fascinating is safety measures sometimes could give us a false sense of security. I one example I think of is like football players. They think that, you know, they have the newest, latest high-tech helmet, but and they think, well, that's going to protect me, so I, you know, it doesn't matter, but yet there's still always a risk. I wondered, like, with these things we do, wearing a mask, using hand sanitizer, are these safety measures perhaps giving us a little bit false sense of security?
That's partially a public health question and partially a consumer psychology question. Seatbelt usage is a good analogy in this regard. Seatbelt usage did not diminish the frequency of drivers speeding. In fact, some studies indicated that it was increased as a result of seatbelts becoming mandatory. That's an example from a different context of what you're describing. I think there is, certainly the risk that people do feel a full sense of security and don't distance. Perhaps that's the key risk, that the mask is viewed as being 100% secure barrier, and as a result, we really don't have to be 6 feet away from each other. So that's sort of an empirical public health question. It depends a little bit on the quality of the mask itself and its impenetrability. But I think it also relates to the consumer psychology as well, that, you know, I'm wearing a mask, I'm doing my part already to be socially responsible. If I'm within 5 feet of you instead of 6 feet, please don't get too upset, because as you can see, I'm doing the mask thing, I'm doing the hand sanitizer thing, surely you can give me a break.
And so the other thing to that too is I wonder about like social pressures. I pay attention to this now when I go places. We've all seen this, right? Is somebody is not wearing their mask or somebody is not social distancing, and their peers around them might actually chastise them for that behavior. They might look at them like, why are you doing that? Why are you putting me at risk? Why are you behaving this way? How does that play in? How does that peer pressure play in?
That's correct. And actually, peers are, in these kind of circumstances, the individuals who can exert most influence typically on the behavior of others. So what you're describing could certainly be evident, but one of the problems is that once the number of people who are not wearing masks starts increasing again, that there is the risk of there becoming a tipping point where there is such a large number of people not wearing masks that it becomes, you know, equally socially acceptable not to wear one as to wear one. So you're no longer the isolated black swan. You know, you're one of a number, and no one can then really sanction you because of the safety you have in numbers of being one of many people not wearing a mask. You know, one of the interesting things, I just think it's interesting to point this out, is that early on in this particular crisis, we were told that masks actually were not necessary unless you were sick, but actually the mask would be good to wear if you had a fever and possible symptoms, but if you were healthy, there was really nothing that the mask could do to protect you.
Right.
And it's interesting how we've evolved from that position to the mask wearing is now a display of social responsibility.
Things change quickly, and I wonder how things will change when we get to the point where we don't have to wear them, how fast or how slow we'll get to that point. John Quelch, again, Dean of the Miami Herbert Business School at the University of Miami. Mr. Quelch, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, still to come, communities like Wynwood depend on visitors. How will the pandemic change these neighborhoods, maybe forever? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. You know, most hotels across South Florida remain closed, with a few exceptions, and the few that are staying open are there to serve what are deemed essential lodgers, like first responders. The Domio Hotel in Wynwood is providing free rooms for Jackson Health Hospital workers. Manny Gonzalez is the executive director of the Wynwood Business Improvement District, which helps facilitate that program, and he joins us now. Manny, great to have you back.
Thank you so much, sir. Thank you for having me.
How did that program at the Domio Hotel start?
Well, basically, we had received an inquiry from the developers of that building that Domio was actually interested in doing some sort of partnership to give back to first responders. So immediately that same day, we made contact with the upper level management over in New York, and they basically okayed a willingness to house first responders as long as we help them make the connection.
And how many hospital workers and first responders are there right now?
Well, we started with about 20. It was about two floors, and it's now expanded to about five floors. So in total, it's about 1,300 room nights that they've provided for our first responders that are literally a mile and a half away.
And how long is that program going to last? I mean, we don't know how long it's going to take for South Florida to reopen.
Now, that's an interesting question. I know that Domio has basically given the commitment, you know, that they would follow through as much as they could. I give them credit because we reached out to over 10 different hotels. And to get clearance from a corporate level, especially them from New York, that for them to do it this fast, you know, it's something that should be really commended.
And who's paying for that?
Right now, they're absorbing the costs. You know, a lot of people were asking for monetary money from these first responders, but they basically absorbed 100% of it.
We're talking with Manny Gonzalez, executive director of the Wynwood Bid, and we're talking about the Domio Hotel. They are housing Jackson Health workers. They're providing free hotel rooms for them. And you can find out more about that on our social media at WLRN Sundial. All right, so Manny, you know, Wynwood, you know, like the rest of South Florida, I mean, it's been hit really hard because it's a tourism, you know, destination, and you have all these restrictions. But what did the figures look like in terms of visitors and dollars from March to April? And looking at last year, I mean, you know, what did you see?
Well, you know, prior to this coming, this pandemic coming, Wynwood was hitting record numbers. We had record visitors, record events. And then all of a sudden, you know, commencing around March 12th, everything ceased. So you're looking at, you know, 90%, you know, 95% of loss of just revenue operations, you know, to follow the guidelines that were recommended.
I've driven around a lot of parts of the city, and I drove through Wynwood a week ago on a weekend, and it just, my mind was blown. I never could have imagined just driving around and seeing, I think there were a few blocks where I saw not a soul. But for you, I mean, what's it been like for you as you're driving around? And I wondered if you're talking to any of these business owners recently about how things are going for them. How are they doing?
Well, what happens is for myself, you know, when I began working in Wynwood, I've been doing this for over a decade for the city, but it's the only neighborhood that at 10 a.m. there was already, you know, 60% capacity of parking.
Right.
Taken.
Yep.
You know, so now as I just left there this morning, you know, because we're doing an initiative cleaning out the streets for the neighborhood, and literally, you know, 95% of the spaces are empty. You know, you have some tourists, everybody, you know, wearing their masks, taking pictures of, you know, our 200 plus murals. But this is something that, you know, it's revolutionary. Now, the business owners, you know, the folks that are food in operation, they're looking forward to, you know, hopefully opening soon. We have retail that's also hoping, you know, hoping to open. So as long as we follow these guidelines, we're also working with other city departments to help facilitate takeout, you know, when it comes by reserving spaces, because at 25 capacity, you have some spaces with six tables. So we're going to have to get creative, work with our partners at the city and the county to, you know, augment that loss.
And that's a really interesting point, is that, you know, in phase one, restaurants can reopen, but again, at very limited capacity. And some of these places, as you said, you know, in Wynwood, they're small. So you're talking about a couple of people. How do you do that? What are some of the discussions right now about getting that creative and trying to figure this out?
So what happens is we have a very strong board. You know, these are the forefathers of the neighborhood. We were lucky enough to survive Zika, which, you know, if you recall, that was, you know, the first, you know, mini pandemic of the neighborhood. And, you know, we've learned a lot of lessons. We've learned that, you know, information from one source is paramount. We've also learned that we need to work with our local operators, like the parking authority, for them to see if they would give us spaces, you know, four or five in front of, you know, some of these restaurants, help augment, you know, some of that lost income that they're going to get. You know, we're also working with developers. We're working, you know, with our local commissioners and local government. You know, we're promoting some of these businesses. We created even a digital campaign called Win at Home that began in April, promoting these restaurants, having digital DJ sets. We had yoga sets to maintain, you know, the minds, these businesses in the minds of our patrons.
And that's restaurants and some retail. The other thing too about Wynwood is that it was a really jumping place for the nightlife. And that's different. The nightlife, the nightclubs, the bars, that's not going to open under phase one. What happens to them?
That is the great unknown, you know. Obviously, we have to follow what guidelines are given to us. We're looking at innovative ways, maybe have like drive-in, you know, theaters, you know, to use some of these large event spaces, you know, but that's right now the great unknown, because we really don't know what guidelines are going to be imposed. But that is a national, international question right now. How do we do that next phase?
And, you know, again, not knowing how long this is going to last. Look, Wynwood was such a popular place, which also meant it was not a cheap place to have a business. I wanted to know what you're hearing from business owners. how long can they hold out? How long can they keep this up?
You know, talking to several, you know, just yesterday, you know, there's some folks, you know, again, luckily we have a lot of forefather property owners, and they understand that in order for us to keep, you know, being the cultural hub of the city, we need to be unique and we need to have, you know, mom and pop type businesses. So, you know, I can't, you know, talk about what, you know, individual maneuvers each property owner are currently doing, but I could tell you that a lot of the businesses, you know, have been offered to remain in their places, you know, until this, you know, opens up, and then they could revisit it. But for us to just kick out, you know, all the retailers and everything, it's just not the Wynwood style.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think about the identity, you know, Wynwood's identity, and how it's developed over the years and evolved over the years. And then this hits. And yes, you had Zika. This may last. It's already lasting longer. This may last a lot longer. And I'm wondering, what do you think is going to happen to the identity of Wynwood moving forward, and what changes?
Well, one of the unique characters of Wynwood is there's legislation, you know, that was brought forth by these property owners to ensure, you know, that these buildings that come up have that Wynwood brand. You know, it'll never turn into another neighborhood. Now, May nightlife, you know, lower, you know, in Wynwood, it's also going to lower everywhere else. So right now, as long as, you know, we maintain this mom and pop character, it's not going to be a corporate kind of a place. We firmly believe that, you know, it's going to come right back, you know, to where it was. You know, percentage wise, we don't know if it's going to be, you know, something forever. But we truly believe that as the cultural hub, the centrality of it, you know, you got to understand it's an open air neighborhood. So it's not like a mall that's enclosed. You know, a lot of these businesses have open air. It's never, you know, you're never going to have that feeling that, you know, you're breathing recirculated air. We have ample parking, and I know that we'll get creative and we'll survive.
Will it remain a tourist destination?
Definitely. You know, you have to understand Wynwood came up at the same time as social media, you know, Facebook, Instagram. So the posts that were being posted in 2005, 2004, that's the currency we work with now. So when we talk, you know, to development groups, visitors, it's the name, number one brand in Europe. There's, you know, several bars. We know of one in Russia, one in Greece called Wynwood. So we truly believe that we have that mark. That's our market.
And again, you said, because you said a moment ago that you think people will come back. But again, you know, and listening to the commissioner from Palm Beach County earlier in the program, you know, there's phases to this. There's phase one, and then we move into phase two. We have to see how things work out, and we hope that there isn't a resurgence of cases. But, I mean, do you think it all comes back at once, or do you think this is going to take a while?
This is going to take a while. You know, there's going to be a lot of learning. You know, we have 50 other states that have 50 other, you know, types of ideas of how to address it. And I think working together, learning from what's happening in other states, you know, we'll implement. We have confidence that our local officials will implement a right plan. They've been doing a stellar job. So we continue the faith.
Manny Gonzalez, Executive Director of the Wynwood Business Improvement District. Manny, I really appreciate the time, man. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me, sir. Have a great day.
And, you know, we'd love to hear from you, because we think about communities like Wynwood all up and down the East Coast. I mean, from, you know, West Palm Beach, you know, up at City Place, and you think about Lake Worth and Boynton, Del Rey, Boca, Los Olas, you know, all these communities and how they've been impacted by this pandemic, and wondering how you think they're going to come back. Always find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLR and Sundial, and let us know. Let us know what you think, how these communities will change forever and how they will come back. Well, that's our program for this Tuesday, May 12th. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we're going to speak with Broward County Superintendent Robert Runcy. Remote learning will continue throughout the school year, but many questions remain about the summer and the fall. And if you have a child in Broward's public schools, we'd like to hear from you. Email us sundial at WLRNnews.org, or again, find us on Facebook or Twitter, on social media, WLRN Sundial. Let us know what questions you have for Mr. Runcie. We'll share them tomorrow with him. Immigrants in South Florida normally send millions of dollars in remittances to their families back home. We're going to look at how this economic shutdown has impacted that regular stream of funds. And public health experts advocate for 6 feet in social distancing. We've been told, keep that 6 feet distance. But a new study from Florida Atlantic University found that particles from a cough can go a lot farther than that. So how far apart should we be from strangers in public? Maybe 6 feet's not enough. By the way, a public service announcement. If you still haven't received your federal stimulus check, it could be because you haven't signed up yet for direct deposit. And the deadline to do that is tomorrow by noon. Otherwise, you're going to receive a check in the mail, and that could take a lot longer. Something for you to think about. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks again for listening. As always, please be safe. Practice that social distancing. We're not out of the woods yet. Remember that you can always get all of your coronavirus updates at WLRN.org/coronavirus. We have a newsletter. Sign up for that. Keeps you updated every single day. Thanks again for listening. We'll talk to you again live tomorrow.